Welcome to Ugeria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ugeria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ugeria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ugeria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Well, good morning. This is Brad. Welcome to the first Wednesday edition of Ugeria Radio. My co-host Sam Grass and producer Lee Cantor are in the studio with us this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Brad. How are things?
Things are great. So last week we were talking about the time change. Do you guys know what related event happened on this day in 1883?
No, Brad, I don't. Do you?
I would have thought you would have known that.
Does it have anything to do with cars?
Nothing to do with cars.
1883?
Actually, it has to do with railroads. On this day in 1883, the American and Canadian railroads instituted the five standard time zones across North America, replacing thousands of local time zones.
So there were thousands of local?
Every town had their own time zone.
Really?
Isn't that amazing?
That's funny.
So now we don't have an excuse for being late anymore because we're all on the same time.
Good stuff.
Fascinating. That piece of information, I'll file that one away.
Yeah, I know. Too much useless information crowding out all the important things I should be remembering. Well, we have another very full house this morning and a great lineup of guests. We have Tony Grieco from Ivy Hall Assisted Living. We've got Lynn Ross from Wesley Woods. And we've got two from DeKalb Medical Center. We got Margie Osheroff and Rose McKeever. So thank you all for being here this morning. We're going to start with Tony this morning. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Sam and Brad and Lee.
Thanks for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tony, I see that from your bio, you are one of seven children.
That is correct. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. And at that point in time, I guess my dad was an only child. And
he went the other way.
And a little bit further down the road, I'll tell you a little bit about how my wife and I have gone. It's somewhat of a similar story, but grew up in Wilmington and went to school at the University of New Hampshire and got a degree in health administration and planning, and just decided to choose long-term care as my profession. I've been in it for 28 years.
Wow.
Had some family members that were in it, and that sort of provided the example. A lot of us in the family, social services, orientation. I did not get the engineering genes in my family. That was my brother.
Tony, so. What spurred you to move into what you call long-term care?
I went, as I said, to the University of New Hampshire. And in the health administration program, most of my colleagues were moving towards hospitals. And I actually did an internship at one. But it was, remarkably, it was a Newsweek article, and it had a picture of a gal on the front, and half of her face was a youthful woman, and the other was an older woman. And the article was called The Graying of America, and it told the story of how America was going to be changing so much in terms of its demographics, where, like, literally 12% of the population was going to be over 65 in 1990, growing up to 26% in the year 2025. That's a remarkable change.
And this was 20 years ago.
1977. Yeah. Exactly. Right. So here I am.
So tell us a little bit about how you got here. What, coming out of college, what was your first job?
My first job was as the administrator of a skilled nursing facility in a little town in Middle Delaware. It was a 94-bed skilled care facility. And for 17 years, that's what I did. I was a nursing home administrator. The last facility that I operated was 370 beds, and that was in a little town called Salisbury, Maryland. And when I was at the Salisbury facility, I began to recognize that there was a need for another aspect of the long-term care continuum, and that was assisted living. It was starting to blossom and develop. And got into it at that point in time, came on board with a company where I was supposed to actually move to Newark, Delaware, just a little bit north of us, and operate a small AL. But instead, what ended up happening was I took a role with them as a regional director down here in Atlanta, oversaw eight properties initially, and then in the year 2000, went on board with Ivy Hall.
So. Tell us, Tony, the difference between a skilled nursing facility and an assisted living.
Great question. In skilled care, there's a nursing presence 24 hours a day. There's nurses on every single shift, and generally the acuity of the residents is much, much higher. Their ability to be able to perform what are known as activities of daily living, bathing, ambulation, toileting, eating, dressing, is severely compromised by whatever diagnoses they have. In assisted living, we're providing assistance with those, what they call ADLs. And there's a continuum even in the assisted living field. We, as for instance, at Ivy Hall, are more of a social model of assisted living. We have a sister community less than a mile away that's more of a medical model. Our residents, there's a few that still drive. I do require 2 hours notice to me before they go out on the road with their car. I hope they're not listening.
So you're not driving.
Exactly, exactly. Our sister community has residents that are a bit more medically frail, and there's also a secure dementia unit at Ivy Hall at St. Ives.
So, what's the most rewarding for you?
The most rewarding, actually, we have residents that have some dementia needs as well, and it's more at the early stages. The most rewarding aspect of what I do, frankly, is just the interaction and the family-like environment that we end up developing as a culture at both properties. And it's not just the resident that we care for. Quite frankly, it's the
family, whole family,
the
right?
Family as well. And it becomes like a small universe with residents, families, and staff members. We all interact with one another. We all become part of the process of caring for the resident. The family goes through trauma, too, when they have to place their mom or their dad.
Is that something where the family really doesn't know what they don't know, that they think that I'm just placing the family member in this kind of facility? They don't realize how it's going to impact them?
Absolutely. And very often, as you can well imagine, what happens is, and I sort of liken it, having children, that it's like that first day of school. The resident, more often than not, does not want to leave their home or an independent setting, but they have needs. They have lost levels of independence. They're compromised visually, from a hearing perspective, maybe cognitively, and it could be for any number of reasons. So when their child approaches them and says, "This is what we think you need, Mom or Dad," it's like, "No, I don't want to do that." And there's resistance. And it becomes our job to try to help facilitate that process of placement.
And how do you overcome that resistance?
Bit by bit. You know, what ends up happening is that the resident will come into us. We have a very endearing nurse. She's extremely qualified from a clinical perspective. She works with the residents. She gets them to understand why they need to be with us. The director of marketing will spend time with the family and the resident. The activities director throughout the tour process will basically share with the resident what their day will consist of. And we actually, one thing that we do is try to get the resident in to sit down with us and have lunch with us, with the family member, and we bring current residents in to sit with them as well. And we say, "We'll leave the room if you'd want." And the residents that live there will say, "You know what? This is not... it's not home, but it's as close to home as you'll get. And if I have to be any place but my home, I want to be here at Ivy Hall." And you can't buy advertising like that.
Tony, when I was speaking with you earlier, you made a statement about the uniqueness or what makes Ivy Hall unique. It had to do with magic. Can you elaborate on that?
I can. It's one of our, just to give you an idea, one of our residents, her name was Evelyn. She's since deceased. She went away with her family for a weekend, and when she came back, I just remember coming in the front door and me greeting her and some other staff members and her saying, "Thank God I'm home." You know, it's so, I don't know whether she had a bad weekend or she just, you know, it becomes familiar. The staff members become part of her family as well as, you know, them being part of ours. And I tend to think that what we do as a society, Sam, is we tend to just look at older people as if they're a different entity altogether. I think I gave you the example earlier of having gone and I was getting some work done on my car, and the fellow behind the desk asked me, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I manage a senior community, retirement community." He goes, and I'll do it in his dialect. He says, "You know what they like? They like kids and pets." Mm-hmm. And I just looked at him and I shook my head and I went, "Thank you very much." I said, "Do you know who they are?" And he goes, "Who?" I said, they are us 20 to 30 years from now.
Right.
That's really, you know, I
maybe he likes kids in pets.
Maybe we'll get him as a resident. Who knows? But I think the other thing is that, you know, they've been referred to as the greatest generation, the elderly, and I look at them as an untapped resource. They have wisdom beyond belief, and they're the history books that we need to listen to every day. So,
how do you create that culture that helps the staff be so attentive and caring?
Well, another great question in the sense that when people go out looking for an assisted living community for mom or dad, and I will tell you that the person that is generally the decision maker is a daughter or daughter-in-law. We guys are just not really tuned into this just
yet.
Yeah,
funny how that goes.
Yeah, it is. It is. Honey, I'm busy. But what's happening is we're getting better at it, and because we're having to. But it's the buildings that are being constructed now are all gorgeous. They look like hotels. And, you know, ours, when you come in, it's got a 25-foot lobby ceiling and beautiful chandeliers and a sweeping staircase. That is not what you're buying. When a family member comes to us and hands us the check, what they're saying is, I trust you. And the reason for that is that when they've gone through the building and they've met the department directors and they've met the staff, I think one of the things that really creates the culture at Ivy Hall is the longevity. We have department directors who've been there for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. We have caregivers that have been there for 11 or 12 years. And that is what really creates the concept of continuity and security for the family member and for the resident.
How long does a resident typically stay in your facility?
Well, the average length of stay is typically 2 to 3 years, but we have a fellow that just celebrated 10, which is pretty remarkable.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, I will tell you, he said he was married for 6 months, and that was enough for him. So this may say something for bachelorhood. I don't know. But the building is it's. I think another aspect of the culture is I say this not negatively towards any other communities, but we're part of a small company. They only own 10 properties. It's based out of Petaluma, California. It's called Premier Senior Living, and myself and a couple of other fellows manage this property in Ivy Hall at St. Ives for them. They have another in Georgia called Medlock Gardens, and then they also have a presence in North and South Carolina. I think the fact that it's small and intimate and locally run really makes a very big difference. When you're, you know, I was explaining to Sam that when you're buying something from Home Depot, you want to go there because the price is great. Things come in on a barge from another country, and it's a great pricing process. You don't buy healthcare like that. What happens is it's got to be local. It's got to be people that know that market, know that area, and have made a connection, and that's wonderful about Premier is that they allow us to run it like it's a decentralized local operation.
Now, you talked about kids and pets, but I know that you do have some groups of kids that come in and volunteer in your organization. Tell us about that.
That's correct, Brad, and actually one of them was yours many moons ago. We have kids in from Perimeter Church all the time, from the Wesleyan community, from just all different types of schools that come in and regularly interact with the residents. The activities program there also involves pet pals that comes in once a month on Saturdays, and they bring in pets that are specially trained to interact with the residents. And they have to go through almost like a licensing process with the person that runs that program. The activities program can consist of anything from something as simplistic as bingo to a pajama party, and I don't want to get into that on the air. The lady
sounds
in the,
a little crazy.
Well, the lady in the teddy, it was a bit much. I'm just kidding. She made everybody laugh. Or going to Harris Casino in Cherokee, so that there's
they have field trips.
Yeah, all the time. Every Monday they go to a restaurant throughout the course of the week to shopping through in and around Alpharetta. Restaurants.
Do you bring in speakers?
Absolutely.
Like entertainment comes to them?
Entertainment comes in on every single Friday. It's called TGIF, and that can be anything from a piano player to a juggler, which he does it. The juggler, he comes from a family of jugglers, and he's incredible. He's actually a computer technician by background, but I usually go in my office when he starts throwing the knives up in the air. So,
knives and fire.
Knives and fire. He's good at it. He's really good at it.
Tony, there is one more characteristic or quality of that you spoke of, and it had to do with your dining room and the food. Can you tell us about?
You got good food there.
It is very, very good food. The chef was a sous chef at the Chateau Alain and the Ritz Carlton.
Wow!
And you know, he came on board back when I first started, and he wanted to be there on a trial basis. And he said to me in his Russian dialect, you let me cook. If you like, I stay. If not, I go. And
it's that simple.
It's that simple. And actually does a really, really good job. The food is very good, and it can be anything from salmon to we had to tone him down from the lamb chops down to macaroni and cheese occasionally. So that has gone over very nicely. It's a huge part of the residence day. There's a lot of participation by the residents in terms of the food committee.
Are they picky?
Very. And won't hesitate for a moment to let you
know.
They
share their opinion easily in this area?
Very, very easily, as well as every other area. And that's what we're there for. We're there to take care of them, and that I think that's why we have people that have been there for long periods of time.
Tony, one last question for you, and that's if you were going to provide a tip for family members, what would it be?
I think that the major emphasis should be, as your mom or dad begins to age, that changes take place. Sometimes they're rapid, sometimes they're slow in their onset, but the key is to intervene quickly. And the great thing about some of the aging trends, when they are placed, residents are placed in an environment like us, like ours, there's clinical oversight, there's nutrition and socialization, and some of those trends can actually be either forestalled or even reversed. We've seen remarkable changes in residents where the family member comes in and says, as I said, you're not going to get mom out of her room, or she's so antisocial right now. But then all of a sudden they just see a dramatic change, and we hear the thank yous from the family members. I think that's probably the key ingredient, is just to be monitoring what is happening with your parents. Sometimes they're here and sometimes they're in another city. If they're in another city, then absolutely positively make sure you have someone checking on them, because many things can happen that you wouldn't be aware of. It's the subtle changes that are generally indicative of something a little bit more far-reaching. So.
Well, very good. It sounds like we need to get our reservations in, at least for dinner.
I will make sure that happens. And I will tell you that, we talked about kids and children, and I have to share with you, too, that one active family in the community is actually mine. And my wife and I have 8 children.
That was the other surprise. So,
that was good. You saved it for the end.
Yeah. Both of our dads, Judy is my wife, both of our dads were only children, and here we are with...
I'm nervous because I have an only child.
Okay, well, there you go. You're going to be a very plentiful grandparent.
I hope that disease is not contagious.
She was a social worker, and as a result of her background was in long-term care as well. So the kids are in the community a lot. It means a lot to the residents. Truly does.
So. Tony, how could our listeners contact you if they wish to visit Ivy Hall and come and see what it's all about?
They could contact us at 770-814-0114 and ask for myself, and I'll be happy to direct them to the appropriate department. Or they can reach us online at ivyhallassistedliving.com. There's going to be a website there for Premier Senior Living, and then the Ivy Hall icon will come up, and just pick that one, and that'll tell you a little bit about us.
Very good. Tony, thank you so much for being with us today.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
So next up, we have Lynn Ross from Wesley Woods Emory University Medical, and she works in the Department of Neurological Movement Disorders. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Lynn, that's a mouthful. Tell us a little bit about what that means.
Well, I'm going to have to correct you just a touch. I'm at Emory University in the School of Medicine, Department of Neurology, in the Movement Disorder Program.
Movement Disorder, okay.
Right. There are two. There's Cognitive Neurology and then the Movement Disorder. So I'm the Medical Social Worker for Movements.
So what does that mean?
Well, that covers Parkinson's disease primarily, Huntington's disease. We have essential tremor, and then there's some what we call Parkinson's Plus. These disorders start out looking like Parkinson's disease, but they gradually morph into something more serious. So we cover a wide range of neurological conditions.
How do these conditions come about? What causes them? And is there a preventative treatment, or what is the...
Or is this like a chronic, like once you got it kind of thing?
Right. They're more chronic conditions. Some are genetic and some are not. There is research going on now in Parkinson's, and they're looking at the environmental factors that could influence Parkinson's disease if somebody possibly has the predisposition, has the genetic component, and then they're exposed to some environmental factor.
What would be these environmental factors so that we can avoid them?
Well, pesticides.
Really? Okay. Pesticides?
Pesticides.
Interesting.
That's the one they're looking at. And
Is it like on food, that kind of pesticide? Or like if you're doing the actual spraying your lawn or something yourself?
No, this is more what farmers used to use.
Uh-huh.
And then it leached into the ground and it got into the well water and that type of thing.
And is this something that's still an issue today?
Yes, definitely. But not like it used to be. With everybody being environmentally conscious, it's gotten better.
Right. This seems to be a little bit of a specialized area. How did you get into this area?
Well, it goes back to 2001. I graduated from Valdosta State and got my master's in social work. I had started in a nursing home as an activity director, and I really, really enjoyed working with the residents. But I realized I didn't really know a whole lot about the aging process and dementia especially. So there was a social work program at Valdosta State University. So I was in the second class and started working in Alzheimer's daycare programs and CareNet, which is for caregivers, and Project Healthy Grandparents. So I worked primarily with the elderly when I first started. And I was a caregiver for my father and my mother and my husband. So I've been an adult caregiver, adult child, and then I've also been a spouse. So caregiving is really, really close to my heart. And that's what I do primarily with the patients and their families, is try to help the caregivers get through this situation, because it is a chronic, all of them are chronic conditions.
Lynn, you mentioned that these are chronic conditions typically manifest in the elderly.
Right.
What is the difference between Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? Is there a clinical, what's the clinical difference, if you can speak to that?
Well, they're both neurological, neurodegenerative diseases, but the brain cells that are being destroyed in Parkinson's disease controls your movement. Dementia, that's where the memory and the agitated behavior and that type thing comes in. But there can be a dementia component of Parkinson's disease. So there is some overlap. Not everybody that has Parkinson's will develop dementia, but it's a possibility.
Okay. So is this there are two separate parts of the brain that are impacted then?
Right, right, definitely.
Are there any warning signs or any little things you can look for if you're a family member?
Well, usually with Parkinson's, it starts out with a hand tremor, and then there's usually some stiffness. You notice that people have problems walking, their gait changes. Those are usually the first things. And fatigue, people are just really, really tired for no apparent reason. And they have, you know, go and have the blood test and nothing shows up. So there's no test for Parkinson's disease. It's strictly you come in, a neurologist examines you, and from your exam, he can tell if that's what's going on.
Based on behavior?
Well, based on primarily the movements.
Oh.
Yeah, more the movements.
And what age group does this principally, when does it manifest itself?
Well, it's primarily an older person's disease. 60, above 60 is usually, but there's a young onset that anyone under 50, they're put in that category. And we're seeing more and more of the young
onset. What is it, Michael J. Fox? Is that what
right,
he has?
Right, yes, definitely. And his started very young.
And that's unusual, though, right?
Right, definitely, as young as he was.
Lynn, you are physically located in a facility or campus that is part of Emory. Can you tell us about Wesley Woods, tell us what it is, and describe the campus for us and what is it all about?
Okay. Well, Wesley Woods is a complex with five different facilities. We have an independent living. We have two nursing homes, one primarily for rehab. Then we have the health center, the Wesley Woods Health Center, where I'm located. There's radiology there and psychiatry are located in that same building. And then we have a hospital. And it's the geriatric hospital, which has a geriatric neuropsychological ward, psychiatric ward.
Wow.
So we cover a lot of things, but it is primarily for older people.
And it is not necessarily for older people needing acute care, is it? I think you described an independent living facility.
Right, yes, definitely, which does have an assisted living floor. So we start from the ground.
So help me understand the difference between the health center and the hospital, and then also you corrected me earlier because Sam gave me bad information.
But that's typical. I at least didn't call you Clyde, did I?
Not yet. Show's not over.
I was going to say the day ain't over. But help me understand the difference there, and then you said you were part of the School of Medicine. And so
how are they all connected and how they work together?
Okay. The health center is an outpatient clinic. Doctors see patients just as they would in their offices, but they only come to the clinic 1 to 2 days a week because these doctors are also professors at the School of Medicine. So that's how we're connected. But Emory has 5-6 different branches of neurology. We have an epilepsy clinic. We have an ALS clinic. So neurology is divided up into a lot of different conditions.
Okay. Lynn, tell us what you find most rewarding in your day in working with these individuals.
Well, as I said earlier, caregiving is special. So I really enjoy helping the families get them started in the process of finding a facility, getting home health care, trying to understand the healthcare maze and point them in the right direction and let them know that there are resources, there are services, but you just have to look for them. And I've already done the looking, so I just can point them in the right direction.
As a social worker, your job description is very broad, isn't it?
Very.
And what are some of the unusual requests that you've had? Is there anything you can think of?
Oh, goodness. Well, let's see. One patient asked the doctor to write a letter to say that he wanted a prescription for a dog because
wow. You can get a prescription for a dog?
Not really. Not from our doctors anyway. But he was going to a resort that didn't take pets, and he had a pet. So he wanted the doctor to give him a prescription so he could take his dog along. And it was on the justification that it helped Parkinson's disease.
And I was wondering if Medicare would pay for that.
Did that work?
No, not yet. Who knows?
Lynn, I know that there is a particular organization that's dear to your heart. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, along with being the social worker in movement disorders, I'm also the coordinator of the American Parkinson's Disease Association Information and Referral Center at Emory, and that is a mouthful.
You love these long titles, don't you?
Definitely. And what that is we provide educational meetings, we have seminars, we have support groups. We support support groups, I guess you could say. We don't have them there at Wesley Woods, but they're all over the city and all over the state. We have a lot of material about Parkinson's disease, which we gladly share. We have a respite program for the caregivers for people who have advanced Parkinson's disease, and we're able to fund some home health care for some really needy families.
If so let me ask the same question I've asked Tony as well, and that is, if you were going to give the family one piece of advice relative to what you do, what would that be?
I would have to say I encourage families to start talking about the aging process long before it comes. So many families wait till there's a crisis, and then they don't know what to do. So I encourage even families where the spouse is maybe in their 40s or 50s, that's not too early to start talking and making the arrangements for what's going to come down the road. And so many families just don't understand the importance of that.
And that's interesting. So how much do you tell someone when you start to notice maybe that there's a tremor or some sort of movement disorder? How you know, because clearly you've already said that this is degenerative, there's no cure, so you don't want to steal their hope, but at the same time you want to be realistic. So how do you how do you evaluate that?
Well, there's a fine balance in that, and I think the more families can get information and find out about what they're going to face, it really helps them to be thinking proactively. But most of our patients have been to their general practitioners who have noticed some things in the movement category and refer them to our neurologist. So our neurologists are specialists within the specialty because they see people with movement disorders.
And I want to ask you how people can contact you, but before I do that, I want to ask you, how do you typically get people? How do people come to you because it's a specialized area, because it's kind of a area that is a next step typically probably for most people. So how do they come to you, and then how can we reach you?
Well, most of our patients come to us by referral from their family practitioner, or other neurologists in the state refer to Emory because it is a specialty within the neurological specialty. And that's how, I guess, most of our patients come. And in the South, there are not too many other universities and schools of medicine that have the type of physicians that we have, that have gone on and gotten more education about strictly just movements. Now, to contact me, my office number is 404-728-6300, and I can be reached at that number. Now, the number for the APDA Information and Referral Center is 404-728-6552. And I don't answer that phone every day. I have a voicemail system, but I will return calls the next day. And I do ask that if they would like information to leave their name and address, and I'll be glad to send them.
And is there a website for the Parkinson's Disease Association?
Yes, it's apdageorgia.org.
Okay, and I know that Emory has a website as well. It's probably lengthy, so.
Well, if you just go to emory.edu and click on the School of Medicine, that'll get you to neurology after several other pages.
Very good. Or you can use Google.
Right, definitely.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Next up, we have two young ladies from DeKalb Medical Center. First up, we have Margie Osheroff, and we also have Rose McKeever with her. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, and thanks for calling us young.
Yes.
You all are both from what I refer to as a cancer support team, but it looks like you have oncology on the page here. Do you go by either?
It's cancer support team.
Cancer support team.
We each have different roles.
Okay, very good.
Margie, won't you tell us how you came to Georgia, a little bit of your background, and how you got into your current position?
Well, I was born in Tampa, Florida, went to New Orleans to Tulane University for college, And later, after doing counseling on a non-professional level, I went back for my Master's of Social Work to Clark Atlanta University. And what really touched my heart was a week-long program after grad school at Harvard at the Mind-Body Medicine program that taught me a lot about alternative therapies and how they can augment traditional treatments for disease.
Was that not taught to you in your college?
No, it was not.
So what made you become attracted to that?
Well, I felt that in so many ways, medicine specializes looking at specific organs and was not looking holistically at people. And I believed in the connection between mind, body, and spirit and felt that all three needed to be addressed to really help people heal.
And does that mind play, that thought, come into play with DeKalb Medical Center?
I was drawn to DeKalb Medical Center because they took a humanistic approach to working with our cancer patients, and they look at mind, body, and spirit. Our chaplains are very much involved in our program, and I, as the social worker, of course, minister to the emotional component as well as financial and education and advocacy. But really everybody on our team and in the cancer center was sort of chosen by our director, Betty Castellani, because she believed in our compassion for our patients and our desire to make their lives as good as possible.
Now, how long have you been at DeKalb Medical Center?
It's almost 9 years.
9 years. How did you come to be at DeKalb Medical Center? What were you doing before that?
I was also in oncology and cardiology as a social worker at Atlanta Medical Center and heard about the services at DeKalb and was drawn there to apply for a job at a point where they had an opening.
Wow, so 9 years. And you said that you all have different roles on the cancer support team. So describe your role.
Well, I work in an office with four case managers, with Rose McKeever, who is a patient physician liaison, and I'm the social worker. So my case managers, who are the first ones to check in on our patients, will make referrals to either Rose or I when they feel that there's complex issues and needs.
What would be a complex issue?
Oftentimes there could be somebody without insurance. There could be people with financial issues. There could be people with mental health issues. There can be a need just for a newly diagnosed patient to have someone really sit with them at that deer in the headlight stage and really give them some skills to empower them, how they can manage not only the information coming in, but the emotions that come with the diagnosis.
And we're going to kind of tag team this, so I just want to say hello to Rose this morning.
Good morning, Brad.
How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Rose, you've got a unique story. You've been at DeKalb Medical Center for, I will say, a lifetime. Tell us how long you've been there, how you came to be there, and what your role is at DeKalb Medical Center in the Cancer Support Group.
I've been at DeKalb Medical Center for 31 years. The first year I was on the surgery unit. And then the second year, I transferred to the medical oncology unit. And I was on the oncology medical unit for 11 years. And then the cancer support team was formed. And I was asked if I would join the team and with honors. And I did that. So I've been on the cancer support team for 19 years.
So the support team's been at DeKalb for 19 years.
Yes,
so.
Our cancer support center, cancer support team, and the center's been is in 19 years.
Is that one of the longest amount of time that one of these centers have been around? That seems pretty good, 19 years. Are there older ones in different hospitals?
I'm not sure exactly about that, but I think we were definitely on the cutting edge.
Yeah, I would think.
Definitely, with Betty Castellani had a vision, and the administration recognized it and empowered her and gave her permission to develop a wonderful cancer support team and program that that we still are having today, and it's still growing. It's very, very large.
How has it changed in those 19 years?
We started off with maybe 7 on the cancer support team, and now we probably have 60 on the cancer
60?
Workers.
60?
Yes,
wow.
Probably. That's we have a big, big team now. We have a very large radiation department, and we have, as Margie mentioned, our cancer support team making up our cancer case managers, patient navigators, and the chaplains, and several physician offices are a part of our team now with gynecological
Evolving in a manner that you're pleased with?
Oh, it's very rewarding and very fulfilling to see the growth that we've had, because we started off with maybe 3 cancer support teams, but now we have support groups for family, for about 3 patient support groups, a men's prostate support group, and a children's group.
Well, it must be rewarding for you to have stayed there for 31 years.
It has been, it's been awesome. I can't imagine a better life than what I've had. It's really phenomenal. And also in our cancer support team program, we have genetic counseling, and we have clinical trials. So we have a big, diverse group.
Right,
so
it sounds very robust in the different options for a patient. There's lots of places where you can touch the patient and their family, I would imagine.
That's exactly right. And the great part, part of the first vision that Betty had was that we would be able to meet the patient at the point of diagnosis and work with them and follow them through the entire journey of their cancer treatment until remission or totally and completely be with the patient and the family. And the neat part about it, when one of our cancer patients are admitted to DeKalb Medical Center, our patient navigators, case managers, follow the same patients and families all the way through from their admission to their discharge. And if they're readmitted, they have the same caseworker working with them. So there's continuity of care for our patients. And
so if a patient's there and then they're going remission for like 6 months or a year and they come back, there's a high probability they'll have the same patient navigator?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow,
and
that's even phenomenal.
We believe so also. And also if they're, say, getting 8 cycles of chemotherapy every 2 or 3 weeks, every time they come back in the hospital, our goal is to let them to have the same patient navigator to be connected with them and support them.
Well, I know for as long as I've been visiting y'all, I've seen kind of the same faces in that room every time I come. So you definitely have some longevity in your staff.
It's a family.
Wow. It really is.
Margie, let me ask you, you know, when people hear the C word, you know, it's scary. And we're seeing much more recovery than we used to. But at the same time, families have to be absolutely terror-stricken when they hear that word. And as a social worker, that's got to be a big part of your job, is dealing with people that are trying to come to terms with the fact that they've got cancer.
And I think that's part of the most gratifying part of our job, is to be able to ease that initial terror and tell them there's a support group they can come to that week and be among other people going through the same journey, who will really sort of lock arms around them and support them and teach them. And we have huge packets of resources that they're given, including educational materials about their diagnosis and how to deal with chemotherapy or radiation.
So that gives them like a comfort, right? Like they're, at first they're probably overwhelmed. They probably think this is it. It's the end of the party for me. And then you give them all these resources and all of a sudden they're like, well, I can do this. I can get through this.
Right. And even if people are diagnosed at a late stage, we've all had experiences with people even then who've had many, many years, because cancer is being treated as a chronic illness in so many cases because of newer treatments.
Right.
And so to let them know that there is hope and there's support and there's information, we give them how to structure a notebook where they learn how to take in all the information, organize it, and help it be an educational tool for them so they become an active part of the healthcare team, not a passive person that's having things done to them.
Right.
But I tell them the more they understand about their disease, the more they help guide the doctors and work with the doctors as to the best way to be treated for them.
Right. Does the support team need a support team?
Yeah, I'm sure.
We are a mutual support team. There are days, I mean, all of us, it's hard to meet anybody these days not touched by cancer and their right. family or loved ones. And certainly in our own team, we've all been touched by it. And we cry, we laugh, we really just hold each other up. Mm. It's a beautiful
process. You must get so much appreciation from the families. That must be rewarding to just have the families just so appreciative of the efforts of you taking care of a stranger, you know, in essence.
We get a lot of sweet cards from people and just things that they say to us. Rose here has gotten a huge award from the Braves for her participation in working with cancer patients for so many years and her outstanding achievements with them. So wow. I think we've all had a lot of thank yous in many different ways.
Now, is the support and information support group and the information only for DeKalb Medical Center patients, or
is it open to anyone? Yeah.
It's open to everybody, regardless of where they're being treated.
Wow. And it's free.
Free? No.
It's free, and we meet weekly. All of our
these support groups are free.
They're free, and we meet wow. weekly for an hour and a half every week. Right. Every Tuesday night, the breast cancer support group, the family, and the patients group is every Tuesday night. There's another Monday night support group, and the prostate men's group is on Monday night. And then the Treehouse Gang is a support group for kids whose parents or grandparents have been diagnosed with cancer, and they meet every 3 months, 3 week sessions.
Now, I know that's near and dear to your heart. Tell us a little bit more about that organization.
16 years ago, we realized, I especially realized there was a big, big need having the breast cancer support group. These mothers and grandmothers were saying, "What do I tell my children? They're irritable, they're cranky, their grades are going down, and we don't know what to do with them. And I've got too much on my plate to even know which way to go." And so I was able to attend an oncology conference for the kids with parents diagnosed. And so I came back and gave that information to our administration, and they said, "Go for it." And so we started, and it's 15 years old now, and you're right, Brad, that it's dear to my heart, and it's very, very successful. It's one of the only cancer support groups for kids whose parents or grandparents have been diagnosed, and it's been going on for 15 years, and it's free. We have people from every hospital surrounding the Atlanta area, and some of our topics are what's going on in my family the first week, and the second week, what's going on in the hospital, and the third week, what's going on with me. So we use it as a support system, but really heavy on education. We allow the kids to understand the treatments for cancer and the side effects from the treatments. And then we take them on the tour of the hospital, and they get to see in a microscope in the lab the red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets and why we have those in our body. They're able to tour the radiation center and see where their parents would be treated. And they get to see an MRI scanner and a PET scan and a CAT scan and the X-ray and meet a radiologist that reads these reports that give them back to the doctors. And so it takes the fear out of the life of these kids.
Right, because they hear the terms and they hear about these treatments and machines. And, you know, in the kid's mind, you know, their imagination makes it into this huge, scary thing. And you show them and they're like, "Oh, this is what it looks like." And then it stops being scary.
That's exactly right. So, you know, you can realize that it not only supports the kids, it supports the parents and the whole
right.
family.
Because the parents probably don't understand either, and they're not saying anything. So right. it gives them a reason to go along and learn, too.
Rose. And there's a great child therapist that works along with Rose, with
Stephanie Medlin.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a unique way for people to support the Treehouse Gang, and I know because I've got a bag full of goodies. Tell us about that.
every year in August, we have a reunion. And during this reunion, all the kids come on a Saturday morning for a pizza party reunion, and they make holiday cards. And the kids can make their own card. Whatever they do is their own individual artwork. And then the hospital prints them. And then this year we had 24 kids, so we've got 24 cards in a pack. And on the back, it's the name of the child and who in their family had cancer and where that cancer was.
Wow.
And it's been very successful.
Is that a fundraiser?
We do sell for $10 a pack, and it basically covers the cost of the printing.
Right. Wow, that's
great.
Well,
you can't buy holiday greeting cards for that.
Well, we appreciate the sponsors that we have.
And let me switch gears quick and go back to Margie. Margie, and I don't see this on the paper in front of me, but last time I saw you, you were talking about something you were trying to get going from a legal perspective for some assistance.
So many of our families have put off doing wills, power of attorney for financial, advance directives, and other legal needs that they have. And if somebody's very acutely ill and needs those forms, or not even acutely ill, but dealing with cancer and wanting to think ahead, we now have Troutman Sanders lawyers coming in every Thursday to do free legals for the patients. This is a pro bono project that Hallie Schwartz from Atlanta Legal Aid worked with me to develop, and they have been a godsend.
What percentage don't have any of those kind of documents? Is it a large percentage?
Huge percent. People always want to put off thinking
about... Is it like 60% or 70 or...
Oh, I would think 75 or
80.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? That is just stunning.
And some people, especially in this economy, going to a lawyer to have that done is not an affordable thing. So, or I see people who've downloaded forms that are really not legal or, you know, they thought would work, but
right,
really aren't.
Because every state has their own rules. It's hard to find a generic form like this, I would imagine.
Yeah, the verbiage can be different state to state. So we get those done, and sometimes in the nick of time.
It can be urgent, can't it?
It can be urgent, and it can be very difficult for families of patients that don't have those and can't pay bills for their loved one.
So that's like wills. Do you do trusts and living wills and all that too?
We do all of that.
Wow.
Yes.
Marjorie, if you had some advice for our listeners so they might avoid some of these pitfalls that you just spoke of, what might that be?
Well, definitely to do things like power of attorney. Your advance directives are the forms that address if you're ever so ill that you can no longer speak for yourself, who you would want to speak for you, and how you would want them to make decisions on your behalf, because they don't get to do what they want. They have to do what you want. So it's a way of keeping you in charge of your health care regardless of your condition. But also for people newly diagnosed, I think it's really important to research the oncologist that you choose. And I always support people in getting a second opinion, even if they love the first doctor, because seeing how two different doctors approach an illness helps to educate you more about the fact that there can sometimes be more than one way to go. And also, it's a relationship that you have to feel comfortable with, somebody you feel comfortable asking questions on. Also is taking a look at who in your life is going to support you through that journey. And if you have a highly organized person in your life who can get all the emails and can telephone numbers for your friends and organize meals and house cleaning and transportation and doctor appointments, it can take that off your shoulders, because the less stress on you, the better. Also, creating a somebody who will go with you to your appointments. It always helps to have an extra set of ears because sometimes we can avoid hearing and taking in information that's difficult to hear. So an extra set of ears, or asking your doctor if they don't mind if you tape record the meetings with them so you can take that information back home, process it, and share it with your family. So and organizing a notebook so you learn to look at your lab values and how chemotherapy may affect you so you know when things aren't right and you can discuss that with your doctor. It makes you a better consumer in the healthcare system.
Rose, I'd like to ask you the same question, but I'm going to ask it in a different, little different slant. What piece of advice would you give a child of a parent who has cancer?
I would encourage them to talk to their parents and let them know how they're really feeling, and encourage the parents to be honest and open to the child and keep them informed. That takes, again, the fear away. But for children, their minds are very, very active, and it's kind of like thinking there might be a boogeyman under the bed, and when they turn on the lights and look, there really isn't. So when they are a part of the family and part of the what's going on in that family's life, it really does make life a lot easier for them.
I'm going to tell a personal story here related to what you just said. I just 8 months ago was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and the very first thing my 13-year-old son said to me when he found out was, "Does this mean I'm going to get prostate cancer?"
That's so typical, Sam. It really is. They do. And a lot of times kids will say, "What did I do? I caused it." Perhaps when I told my mommy or my daddy I didn't like them anymore, or I slammed the door, they really feel like they could be responsible. And we bring that out in the our support group with the kids. And Stephanie does a great job with that component of letting them know that no, they didn't. But it's also a good place for them to come to our support group, that they can express their fears and their feelings and be with other kids that have those same feelings, and that validates them.
If our listeners want to reach the Cancer Support Group, how can they do so?
Our DeKalb Medical Cancer Center's number is 404-501-5701. And
their website?
It would be DeKalb Medical, www.dekalbmedical.org.
Very good. Well, again, thank both of you. Thanks to both of you for coming today.
Thanks for having us.
Great information.
It's a pleasure.
And thank you to all of our guests. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in today. To hear this show after the fact, if you're not tuning in live, you can go to our website, which is www.ugeriaradio.com. And remember, if children are our nation's greatest asset, seniors are our nation's greatest treasure. Tune in at the same time next week for another great edition of Ugeria Radio.
Ugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.